KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I have on the show my colleague Lee Rainey of Elon University, who is the director of the Imagining the Digital Future Center, after spending 24 years at Pew, also having been the managing editor of U.S. News and World Report, and I learned about his work at the New York Daily News. Lee is one of the country's leading collectors of information about the internet over 24 years with my colleague Jana Anderson, putting out annual reports that summarized the viewpoints of dozens and dozens of experts across a range of areas on starting with the internet. What is the internet? What does it look like? What it might be doing? Where is it going? And continually has put out these reports that are wonderful compendiums of where people think we are and where people think we're going. This report that has come out on April 2nd in this 2026, and this show is being recorded for airing tomorrow, April 3rd, Friday, 2026, is called Building a Human Resilience Infrastructure for the AI Age. The subtitle for it, which I think explains it even better, experts call for radical change across institutions and social structures, warning that AI will be significantly more influential in the next 10 years or less. This report, and I should say by way of caveat that I believe I responded to the survey, so I'm one of the people that was surveyed on this, although I have not been involved in putting the report together, and of course the responses are anonymous, runs a whole range of areas. What's fascinating about this kind of research and why it's so important, right, particularly dealing with AI, is that there are all kinds of predictions that people are making with regard to what AI can, will, and cannot do. And of course, we've got an entire range of concerns with regard to AI. On one side, we've got the pejorative term doomer, referring to people who believe that AI is more or less going to end humanity as we see it. And by the way, there are some very, you know, very powerful people and very knowledgeable people who kind of share that view. Jeff Hinton, for example, the godfather of AI, who won the Nobel Prize, has raised concerns more or less close enough to that, saying we really don't know what this technology can do. But of course, on the other end, we also have optimists, I'll put them that way, right? Or maybe we can call them utopians, who kind of don't see downsides to AI. Now, at this point in April 2026, I would say that most people, even those that are very much promoting AI, recognize that there are downsides, even if they downplay them. So I think it's fair to say that as opposed to, say, 2023, AI has developed quite a bit more. However, it's being driven by the private sector. And the private sector obviously is in the business of selling technology as opposed to creating it for the public good. And so trying to find very good information about what AI actually is doing, and more importantly, for those that aren't experts, where might we find concerns? Where should we be concerned? What else can it be doing? And perhaps most importantly, how do we deal with it, is where this report is so valuable. This report, again, is available on the imaginingthedigitalfuture.org website. It has been released, and Lee, my colleague, is available. I'm now, who knows how many emails you get now, Lee, for discussing it. Let's dive right in. Lee, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and discussing this very important report.
It's great to be with you, Dave, and I love being described as a collector of information. I will admit and delight in that descriptor, because I'm usually channeling other people, other smarter people who have pulled together some thoughts that I am happy to pass along to the rest of the world. The other thing, just to say at the outset of this conversation, is that one of the real delights of coming to Elon University is becoming much more tightly affiliated with you. It's been wonderful to get to know you better, and I've been an observer and lover of your work for a long time, but it's nice to be your pal too. Well,
I feel the same way, Lee, right back at you. And I think you know, right, I say collect Freedom of Information affectionately and with respect, because it is not easy to do, which is kind of where I want to start before we even dive into the substance, right? This is ambitious stuff. And I've done some empirical work, but not at this level. Give my listeners kind of a big picture of how you put a report like this together, right? And what it takes, because it really is remarkable.
The origin story of this work is pretty interesting too. When I went to create the Pew Research Center project studying the internet and digital life, the inevitable thing that happened when I went out in public to speak about our work, and we were gathering lots of information about how people use the internet, what it was doing to them, how they felt about it, what they thought some of the lights and concerns were about it. When I went to audiences, if you can remember back to that era, they wanted to know what's the next big thing.
Yeah.
Because there were just cascading numbers of really interesting innovations that were coming out at the turn of the millennium. And I felt like I didn't want to give that answer myself because I didn't know as much as I should. But in channeling experts and getting involved with experts was a good way to sort of help address that question. And the starter of doing this work where we canvassed experts about the future of the internet actually began at Elon with the person who was assistant professor, Connie Brook, who now is the president of the university and a fan of this work. And I found Professor Jana Anderson early on, who is a big she's a hustler, and she is a polymath, and she loves to study these things. And we began to compile a major database of experts, people who had done commentary, major articles, major conference presentations, anybody who had been smart about the internet. We began to collect a massive database of them and began to ping them about things heading into the future. And they have a pretty good track record of predicting big things like the rise of mobile connectivity and its importance. And it's basically overtaking wired connections to the internet. They predicted extremist groups early on before things happened. They understood some of the downsides of social media before they became part of the more public tech lash that occurred in the 20 teens. So this year, we pinged those experts as part of a trilogy of efforts we began since I came to Elon and carried over this work from my Pew life. The first one was to just ask these experts and then ask the general public about the impact of the artificial intelligence on both individuals and institutions. And, you know, people have concerns. Experts have a lot of concerns about hallucinations and misinformation and fake media slop and stuff like that. And the public has concerns that sometimes aligned with the expert concerns and sometimes were more extreme and more worrisome than expert concerns. So we did that work and documented that. And then last year moved on to basically take up the challenge that we got in 2023, which was to say, how are humans going to change when these new intelligences come into existence? How is it going to basically disrupt all that we think about ourselves and our meaning on the planet and in our own lives? So we did a survey about the impact of the internet on things like social intelligence and creativity and curiosity and basic human trust. And in that report, we got some pretty downcast points of view. And so we basically documented all the ways that people have concerns about this. And I think one of the really interesting insights in your beginning of this was that I feel like the wheel has turned basically since January, when AI agents, particularly OpenClaw and other things like that, became a vastly more popular and sort of public presence in people's lives. And I think concerns have grown also as we've gotten the first wave of data about some of the hiring problems that new graduates from universities are facing because AI systems are being used to substitute for some levels, particularly of entry level work. So we decided to sort of flip the script and think about resilience. We've documented in lots of ways the concerns people have, and we wanted to now basically say, how are we going to work our way through this? And are there strategies to be used? And that became the basis of this report we're putting out today. And the headline we're stressing, as you noted, is there was so much commentary about starting with institutions.
Yes.
You know, as people look back on the history of human adaptation and response to disruptions, it tended to be personal qualities like grit, Basic adaptability, like being able to sort of pull yourself up and get along to restore your life to where it was before a disaster occurred. The big insight of these experts now is that institutions are needed to lead the way, in part because those human traits are facing a system, literally a system that's being embedded in everyday life. There was a really nice insight from a couple of folks that basically said AI is becoming the human operating system as it becomes more embedded in the processes of life now. So they began to talk us through some of the institutional changes as well as other kinds of changes that they recommended. And it was fun to do.
I'm sure. Yeah, just give it nuts and bolts, roughly how many experts, where did you find the experts? How do and I'm imagining, pun intended, that there are going to be people listening saying, I want to be one of the people surveyed. So how do you find those people, and who are they, and generally speaking?
Well, we're constantly trolling the internet for insights from smart people. And sometimes they're credentialed smart people. They've got PhDs, or they work high up in tech companies, or they're inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame. And we got a lot of those people as part of our survey. And in this particular case, we were particularly interested in rounding up people who knew the literature and had interesting things to say about the psychology and personal emotional responses to disruptions and resilience. And there was some literature about grief, for instance. It was really interesting in informing this work. So we round up people who have commented on this, who have appeared in journals, who have made major conference presentations, written books about things like this. And then we just invite them open-endedly to respond to our series of questions, and then an open-ended essay question in this report. So it's an opt-in kind of exercise. We invited about 6,000 people to participate here. Just under 400 responded. Several hundred wrote very impassioned essays about this. And so the quality of the insights here is basically rests on those essays. It's not so much quantitative data as much as people really hauling off on this subject and having fascinating things to say about the AI age and what it will mean to our future. And so we'll keep compiling more essays or more expert essays as we head into other subjects in the future. But it's a sort of shoe leather kind of effort to find people and then invite them and make sure people understand that we're legitimate researchers and that we want to give honor to the things that they have to say. And we're not pursuing an agenda on this work. We are not AI enthusiasts. We are not doomers. We are just basically asking a lot of questions about what's around the corner.
Well, and that gets to, look, I mean, your decades of experience as a journalist, and shoe leather work, right, is exactly what the journalism profession needs in order to maintain its credibility. And so just by way of disclosure, right, the funding behind it comes from whom? Comes from
It's
Elon, comes from
Elon
Pew?
underwrites it itself. We've done some fundraising with foundations like the Knight Foundation and places like that. But it's philanthropy and entirely it's sort of money out of Elon that is underwriting this work.
And last question by way of disclosure. So are you actively finding people who have industry connections as much as people who don't? Or are you aware of those kinds of backgrounds? So if someone responds to a survey, are you doing background to see where they're coming from, in or is it truly randomized in that sense?
Well, it's diversified in
Yeah,
that
yeah,
sense.
yeah.
We are very anxious to have people who are building the stuff. And we had some people from OpenAI that responded to this survey. We had people from Anthropic that responded to it. There are a couple of Google employees who are big participants. I mean, one who does so publicly is Vint Cerf, basically the godfather of the internet protocols and the godfather of the internet, who has been a longtime supporter of our work and contributor to our work. So we do go hunt for those people. And the other thing that we do, of course, is offer people anonymity when they respond to this, because we know the people who are embedded in companies and sometimes embedded in public policy work and things like that don't want their personal views tied to their names and things. So we offer that option. And about a third of the respondents choose to be anonymous and not want to be quoted in their essays and things like that. So we don't quite know in some cases who they are and where they come from. And in other cases, we know who they are, but we are honoring their wish to remain confidential in this work. So again, we try to be diversified. I think if you look at the respondents, those who disclose who they are and want to be acknowledged, there are a lot of academics and pundits and commentators who are in our database. And they sort of start from a position of skepticism and critiquing things and kicking the tires and things. But it was interesting over the years. I mean, we've been at this since 2002, basically. And it was interesting to watch their early evolution in, for instance, turning against social media. And many of them were enthusiasts at the dawn, 2008, 9, 10, of social media. It was going to be democratizing lowercase d on this. It was going to bring many more voices into the public square. It was going to cut down the gatekeeping function that media and other gatekeepers played over what ideas were in play in audiences. And a lot of people thought that was nothing but good in the world. But soon enough, certainly starting 2011, 12, the Edward Snowden revelations were a big turning point for a lot of these experts in thinking not so great things about the future of the internet. And in a way, it's been striking to see how the critics of social media who came to prominence and were leading the tech lash concerns of 2015, 16, 17 have become sort of an institutional pushback against artificial intelligence. And they were in place on day one, certainly when the sort of public versions of artificial intelligence, like their arrival of ChatGPT in November of 2022 and things, the sort of skepticism, if not outright dismay and hostility towards AI, was sort of baked into the infrastructure of society at that point. And in many respects, from the earliest work that we've done on AI, there that those voices of criticism and concern and soundings of warning were a big part of the story.
Yeah. We're chatting with Lee Rainey of Elon University, co-author along with Jad Anderson of Building a Human Resilience Infrastructure for the AI Age, a report released today, April 2nd, 2026, by Imagining the Digital Future. Look, Lee, I mean, there's so much to talk about here. Let's go right at the core, some of the core findings that you're the experts that you surveyed. And again, I am unabashedly going to say this again. It's incredible that you got 386 people to respond to a survey. I mean, anyone who does empirical work knows, forget it. I mean, that's really hard. There are predictions, right? And I want to highlight the ones that you highlight right up front, right? 82% say AI is going to have a larger role in shaping our daily lives. 56% say that AI will be influencing how we make decisions as human beings. 45% have concerns about humans being resilient with regard to this technology. And only, which is interesting that you have the modifier only 33% said people will be more satisfied than dissatisfied with AI systems at that time. That's a wow, right? Right up front, the experts, two-thirds, right, more or less are saying, no, we're not going to be thrilled with where this goes. Full stop. That's our beginning point, isn't it?
Well, we do that as a level setting exercise and to get our experts sort of warmed up to be thinking about the essays that we invite them to write. And we also want to know where they're coming from. We want to make sure that we've got a pretty decent distribution of views on things like that. And we kind of knew from previous surveys of these same batches of experts that they were going to have concerns, and we sort of pressed them on what the timetable was for concerns. So it was really striking to us, and it's the first bullet point that we emphasized in the list that you read. 82% think this is coming in the next decade or less. So they're watching the way that AI systems are spreading through healthcare, insurance systems, utilities systems, government agencies, and the kind of decision making that goes on there. And it was what we found too in this is that although there are lots of ways that particularly the doomers that you quoted at the beginning of this program there's existential concerns and whether this is going to wipe us all out. One of the sort of through lines of the commentary here is that certainly in the next decade, as AI spreads more and more into everyday life, the impact is going to be a quiet, almost invisible impact because it's just being baked into the things that already exist in our lives. We have to get utilities. We have to, live in communities. We have to sort of live with the systems of economic life that we are all a part of. And it's not, these experts are arguing, at least in the shorter or medium term, the disruption is not going to be killing us all or, ruining everything for everybody. It's going to be a quiet thing. And their argument related to that is we won't necessarily notice. In the ways in which we are being shaped by, steered by, influenced by, judged by AI-infused kinds of systems. And so that's one of the big arguments that they make about the need for an institutional first response here, rather than having individuals sort of work their way through these processes themselves. Individuals have a limited amount of power, institutions have larger power. And it's so striking to hear that line of argument in the current moment in America, where Americans' trust in institutions are just, couldn't be any worse. And the sense that building institutions now is almost a heroic act. It's not just a necessary part of modern life and being in bureaucracies and things like that. It's coming in an environment that's so deeply polarized, so deeply distrustful, and so deeply sort of dismayed about the current life, that this is a major ask of the systems of society to sort of take the lead in evaluating AI, insisting that AI processes work the way that they do and things like that.
You know, I launched Hearsay Culture in 2006. We're coming up in a month on the 20-year anniversary of it. I have to figure out what to do about that. I've been kind of busy with teaching, what Elon pays me to do primarily. But I launched it in 2006, and I called it Hearsay Culture because I was concerned that technology, particularly the internet, was going to make it difficult to tell truth from fiction, right? And that we were going to have that kind of issue. And I didn't. I think history's borne that out, and I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back because I was also hopeful, which is my question for you, that we'd have tools to address them. AI, in theory, should be that tool, right? In theory, it should be happening, but I noticed one of the through lines in the report, right, is a very, very deep concern tied to the institutional issues that the technology is not being developed with those goals in mind.
Yeah, and it was actually a sort of interesting thing to observe as particularly language models came into being and came out in the culture. There were lots of ways that from inside and outside companies, people were expressing concerns about this and also trying to apply AI tools to the things that they were doing in life. What has really dominated the dynamic, though, is two big things that have happened in the past couple of years. The first is the capitalist competitive dynamic, which is that as much concern as there was inside these companies, and certainly they were being pressed from outside forces to be concerned about some of the problems that were deeply identified related to these systems, the fact that there's now an arms race to get to general intelligence, if not super intelligence, first is inhibiting any kind of strong emphasis and strong concern about alignment issues and just the general problems associated with AI, because they're just thinking that, it's a winner take all market. If you get to AGI first and artificial general intelligence first, you win the species lottery. You basically clean up in a powerful sense and certainly in a money making sense and things like that. The other thing, of course, is that particularly in the Trump era, when the president has declared the policy of the United States to be better than China and get there first before China, because if they get there first, it's going to be a big problem for us, if not an existential problem for us. And so in many respects, that is means the guardrails are off, or the guardrails that were at least being conceived of are not necessarily being deeply pressed for, certainly inside the companies as they were for a while. And so that's a dynamic that's related to this, even as there are sort of very broad consensus, certainly in the expert community, but even in society, that there are things to be working on and things to be worried about. There are not easy ways to invoke those kinds of public pressures and even institutional pushback, because it's, we're supposed to beat the competition, we're supposed to beat the geopolitical sweepstakes for who gets to rule the world on this stuff.
Yeah, and looking through the commentary and the analysis, right? That's another theme that I want to explore a little bit. One of the things that seems to come through here, right, is a general sense, which is not brain surgery, that we need rules, right? And yet there's very little in terms of what to do, right? Not with what the rules are, but how they should even be made. Because it's not just, of course, as you know, right? It's not just a problem in the United States, right? That there's deregulation. Obviously, the AI Act in Europe, right, is in that sense the polar opposite, but there's massive pushback there as well, right? In fact, there have been recent comments by senior EU officials saying, by having all these regulations, wait for it, we're losing the race, right? And we need to unleash. And so the forces that are driving all of this, and of course, and that's putting us, what I've been mentioning, China at this point, right? Just focusing on the EU and US is very much in the direction of the old saying, move fast and break things, which has always been the Silicon Valley ethic, right? Why should we treat AI based upon the experts any differently? Is it just because that the risks are greater, or do you sense from the experts' opinions that there's more to it than that?
Well, it's all encompassing. Yeah. So in a way, it is more than that. Certainly compared with the things that I was studying at the Pew Research Center at the dawn of the internet and broadband as a public commodity, and at the dawn of social media and mobile connectivity and things like that. So, an obvious point to make here is that AI is a different kind of tool. In human history, tools have always heretofore been created to enhance human physical capabilities. They made us stronger and faster and able to do things more efficiently than we could on our own with our own sort of native skills and talents and strengths and speed and things like that. This is the first set of tools that's challenging our cognitive capacity. And then you're right. Once you get there, you are right, essentially, in wondering about, thinking about, challenging the essence of being human. There are greater intelligences now on very specific fronts than we are on these things. I mean, the obvious examples coming from the 20-teens, where they can beat us at chess handily. They can beat us at the Korean game Go handily. They are protein folding is now in the domain of artificial intelligence rather than the human domain, because it's so much better at doing those things. And so there's an enormous psychological and existential set of implications to this. Who are we when greater intelligence are in play? And there are good answers to that. They're sort of our social capacities and emotional capacities and decision-making capacities and things like that. But AI is even getting pretty good at simulating that and giving evidence of that. If you look at the way people, for instance, are treating AI companions that they're creating, sometimes inside a company system, sometimes doing it on their own, they're pretty compelling things. They people anthropomorphize them, of course, in part because they're so nice. They've got nice voices. They say nice things. They never push back against your weird ideas. They never sort of turn you down when you're bugging at the wrong hour. They never create arguments for you. And so there are ways in which the sort of basic qualities of being human are now on the table in a way they've never been before. You, as much as anybody else, knows the degree to which this is now a big argument in the legal rights community. To what extent do we need to be treating AI instruments as independent legal actors in the same way that we have already allowed non-humans in the form of corporations to be sanctioned, recognized, rights-bearing actors. And even some animals now are coming close to that right. So this is basic stuff. I mean, you know, philosophers from millennia ago and certainly religious leaders through the ages have been thinking about what it is to be human, what are our special qualities and things. And now this is front and center for the entire species.
We're chatting with Lee Rainey on Hearsay Culture and KZSU-FM Stanford. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University. It requires donations from listeners like you to continue its programming. People think that Stanford funds KZSU, but it really is funded by donations and others. Please reach out at donate@KZSU, at stanford.kzsu.edu, or, right, you can also simply reach out to me, and you can check out hearsayculture.com, where we are pushing forward in 2026 with new shows and new programming, and more about that as we lead up to the 10-year anniversary. Lee, there is so much in this report. I want to ask you what I think is low-hanging fruit, but it's a great question to ask, which is the most surprising through line that you came through from this report, right? You go into a study, you go into empirical research with certain assumptions of what you're going to find. Is there anything here that you read, that you discovered, that you're reporting that you surprised you based upon where you thought things were going to be?
I must confess that the sort of headline itself that we ended up writing on this report was the biggest surprise of this. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're emphasizing it, because it's not a sort of commonplace piece of conventional wisdom. So much of the conversation about AI is between the doomers and the enthusiasts. Yep. And it exists at the existential level. Is this going to kill us? Is this going to save us? What was so striking, and it came from so many different points on the sort of academic spectrum and the thinking spectrum, as well as the geographic spectrum, is that at least in the short term here, the challenges posed by AI are going to be challenges that are quiet challenges. Are we going to defer to it as we make decisions? Yep. Are we going to think that it's smarter than we are if we confront something where we have imperfect information? As a matter of fact, when we did a public opinion survey through the center last year on that, about half the people said, well, yeah, I think the language model I'm using is smarter than I am. Yep. There are ways in which, you know, the AI systems can draw on, you know, all that's known, at least in the training models of this language, which is basically everything that's scrapable on the internet, as well as lots and lots and lots of books and things. So it was this notion that it will be a quiet conquest, that more than a big bang moment when AI sort of asserts its influence in our lives. And that because it's a system, because it's being embedded in so many of the basic elements of everyday life, it will take institutions to push back most strongly and comprehensively in order to make sure that human resilience is propped up and human well-being is retained and human autonomy and agency is the thing that's prized still by these systems. So that was the biggest surprise. And there were sort of a couple of other related things that I got way excited about when I began to read them for the first time here. There's a big conversation already underway about AI literacy, and every K through 16 institution is thinking about what do they have to add to the basic things that they are teaching their students about how to be a literate human being in this world. And literacy is sort of a 18th, 19th century concept, and we've got to add to it. But there were some of these experts who basically said, look, the cluster of literacies about knowing how AI works and where it comes from and how to be wary of it is part of the package here. But they argued that existential literacy is a thing to be thinking about. Since this is a whole, all-encompassing set of systems in our lives, we've got to think in whole ways about what it takes to be an active, a happy, joyful human being who basically has ways to enjoy the life that we have. Yep. And so existential literacy is sort of basically it's a rallying cry for the humanities disciplines, I mean, which have had such trouble in recent years, as you know, enrollment hasn't necessarily been too high in them, and there have been ways that institutions have not been kindly about that. But in a way, this report, in some respects, is a rallying cry for all kinds of academic leaders and practitioners to think again about the essence of being human and the special qualities that we bring to each other when we talk about each other, when we create art around each other, when we do other kinds of creative things in our midst, and certainly when we do collective things to solve problems. You know, humans have only survived as a species on this planet because we do collective intelligence. We're not, you know, we couldn't have beaten saber-toothed tigers on our own.
Yeah, right.
We couldn't have beaten, in some sense, some of the machinery on our own. But we've basically conquered the planet because we can live anywhere, and we can do that in part because we can work together to do things and solve problems and collectively figure out how to disseminate problem-solving solutions throughout the species. We discover that germs cause disease,
Right.
and we build up whole systems to make sure that the world knows that.
So you alluded to it before, and I want to step a bigger picture on the role of this, right? You alluded to institutions, right, repeatedly as being the bulwark, right? And yet institutions, right, are under attack, right, in the United States and globally. And of course, people are in many ways, ironically, decentralized now more than ever, right? I don't need to interact with the mainstream media, right? I don't need to interact with my neighbor. I can go on into the internet world, right, such as it is, and find quote unquote my people, and my people are disparate, and I can stick with my people, right? It's this is you know, individualism writ large. Do the experts think there are any institutions who can handle this in 2026? I'm not just talking US, globally.
By implication, they suggest institutions. They haven't basically said place your chips on
Right, and
this
that's why
place or
I'm
not.
asking.
But by the things that they recommend, they're basically giving a pretty clear message that things like treaties, global treaties, they've worked in enshrining human rights, in enshrining the way we treat information and things like that, in regulating threats and existential kinds of things that menace the whole species. And so there's an argument that some of these experts make about, sure, we can go head to head with China on a bunch of things, and you know, the dynamic of that is almost unavoidable. Nevertheless, why shouldn't we have trust-building mechanisms between our countries, the way we did as we were developing nuclear arsenals, to basically say, "Hey, we saw this problem the other day, and how a runaway system can, AI system can go kablooey. We saw a problem about an AI being deceptive and knowingly sort of trying to fake out human beings. Let's figure out how to stop that, and let's put some pressure on individual governments to make sure that that doesn't happen, or to make sure that at least there are reporting systems so that we know when these things are underway." So in a way, it's a vote of confidence in the international treaty system that we already have. In other ways, they talk about sort of obvious communications-based regulations where the companies at a minimum ought to share with the ways in which these systems failed the tests that we give them about aligning with human values and being ethical in their behaviors and things like that. Making the companies report that just would change their and put them in jail or fining them amazingly high amounts if they don't do that. There are ways that institutions still have the guns and the leverage and the power to make people behave if they really want them to. So in a way, for all the troubles that you know, institutions have, these experts are basically saying they still have got a lot of firepower when it comes to regulating these things. There are ways in which they think AI systems can be used to combat some of the problems of AI systems, and they want, for instance, like tax incentives or direct on subsidies. As you know, there are lots of you know, very powerful arguments now for local media in particular to be essentially something that governments help out with their tax policies, with their zoning policies, with their regulatory policies, and even by direct subsidy, because in the world heading into the future, trust is going to be the most precious commodity. Well, trust and attention, I guess, we should share the stage
Yes.
of being the most important qualities. If we don't have trust, we don't work together and we get hammered. If we don't have trustworthy information on which to base our decisions and to sort of collectively assess what the world is like and agree how what's going on and certainly agree what the problems are to address, that's a problem too. So there's kind of a encouragement to use the levers of power that governments have, whether they're trusted or not, to sort of push things towards providing trustworthy information, letting people themselves. I mean, right now, there aren't real clear laws. If you've been harmed by AI or you think you've been harmed by it, to at a minimum, contest the thing that made your life miserable. So contestability is something, the legal structure, one of the great votes of confidence in the in this, again, implicitly more than explicitly, is just like, let the lawyers fight it out. The case law itself is going to be really important to figuring out where things can go right and things can go wrong with these systems.
Of course, hopefully, right? Because one of the challenges with reports like this is that you do have a lot of crystal ball work, right? You've got, which is not a bad thing in its own right, but these are all predictions, right? Hopefully the law, which has been under attack in the United States and elsewhere, right, will have the resilience that it needs in order to address these issues. I found it interesting and I don't want to pivot a little bit to some of these fundamental bigger questions. Right. And I think this is not necessarily a reflection of the fact that the experts don't know. Right. But in many ways, the shortest part of the report is making our way on the path to human flourishing. Right. It's like the old cartoon. Right. Of the mathematician. Right. At the chalkboard with all these numbers and letters and whatever else. And then, and then a miracle happens. Right. That's the part. There was a great Onion TED talk that said, I figured out a way to, power automobiles with human waste. Right. And it's your job to figure out how we can actually do it. It's like that kind of stuff. Now, the report is not designed as a policy document, and that's the really important point that I want to emphasize here. We need the data from people that actually know what they're talking about to sense where the issues are and where they aren't, right? And there's much of that in this report, and I'm not sharing my own personal opinions, that's not the focus here, but a big part of the report is let's not focus on that, let's focus on this. Which brings me to the question of the media, right? Near and dear to both of our hearts. What is the role, in your view, of the press, right? And I'm not talking about, obviously, accuracy, and I mean, that's basic stuff. But really, when we're talking about understanding this kind of technology that the experts themselves, right, have a hard time explaining, have a hard time predicting, and by the way, we don't even really understand fully how it works, right? Particularly generative AI. We can't really explain, and I'm talking about I'm not talking about experts even within, although some of them are in this report, but experts of computer science can't explain the outcome. What's the role of the media here? Because we're on Hearsay Culture. This is KZSU Radio. It's also a podcast. This is a report that's available on the internet. People hopefully will read it. Obviously, that's the goal. But what's the role of the media here in helping us address this big issue of AI?
I would say the new role that comes out of our study of this material really harkens to traditional things of journalism, but it's now a front and center, critically important issue, is just understanding and documenting the provenance of information. So many of us have so many questions about where information comes from and who authors it and stuff like that. There are lots of ways for people to fake out the systems and create deep fakes and other kinds of slop that get into the system. So a sort of brand new call to anybody who's in the knowledge business, doesn't have to be journalists, but they should be in the forefront of this, is sort of prove your work and prove it's you who made this work. That is a sort of baseline kind of thing. The other things that the journalists have traditionally brought to the story is to, first of all, reflect what's going on in society. And it's perfectly fine to reflect that there are problems and there are bad actors and there is bad information, and stuff. But there also is the obligation to track down diverse information, other kinds of information, not sort of rest on your laurels of sort of saying this is the end of the story. Because there's always more. Science has showed us that even with its own enshrined scientific method, there's always more to the story in most cases. And journalists sort of sticking at that is and basically convincing the public that, don't hang your hat necessarily on all of this. Stay vigilant and make sure that you even use the best material you could find to make the argument that you're making. So, sort of going on the hunt for diverse sorts of information, other kinds of information is a primary thing. The other thing is just sort of a commandment of journalism is bearing witness to what's going on. Journalists don't have to have points of view. As a matter of fact, many of us may say, and a lot of data from public opinion says, we don't want our journalists to come to us pre-baked with their own ideas and their own agenda. And so the mindset of being open, the mindset of being curious, the mindset of thinking, I've got stuff to learn and I'm going to pass along that learning if it makes sense to you. So bearing witness to your journalist's own journeys in tracking down the truth. The other thing that I go back to my days as a journalist. The classic argument is that journalists' power in many cases comes from the way they frame stories. That what they choose to cover and how they choose to cover it is the way that they basically set agendas for communities and larger physical and psychological groups of people and stuff like that. So there's a demand for humility in that. But there's also a demand that that you're representing something bigger than yourself. And so when I was studying trust for Pew in particular, and it absolutely shapes the work that I'm doing now at Elon, the fragility of truth of trust is now, a foregone conclusion. And what we ended up finding in so many respects is that it's sort of a lost cause. Many people think at the national level and certainly the international level, the community level is where the rebuilding, the resilience building starts. And so many people would say to us, when there's a local problem to solve, when there's a local disaster to confront, you don't care what your neighbor voted in the last election. And you don't care what their religion is, and you don't care what their race or ethnic background is. You need their help, and they need your help. And there's plenty of evidence that people put down their differences and work shoulder to shoulder to solve problems. And the shoulder to shoulder model, where you're not, you're yelling at each other about politics, or you're not sort of trying to dunk the other person. Trust building takes place at the level of cooperation to solve problems, and the hope is that at the community level, it eventually works its way up the food chain to larger things. But it's a gigantic problem.
One of the and we have a few minutes left here, Lee, and I know that you've got other media to attend to, launching this terrific report. A couple last questions. So, to me, one of the aspects of this that isn't reflected as much in the report, are the direct economic. I mean, they are mentioned, but not reflected as much as I might have expected. Are direct economic impacts on jobs, right? And the ability of people to work specifically, and then even more specifically on the economy. So for example, there's Bloomberg this morning had a report about how RAM chips are just skyrocketing in price, right? Driving up, not because of the need that AI companies have for them, driving up the costs of every other device that has RAM, right? They're saying, and I'm not saying this, the report says it, one expert says, buy your laptop now. But also raising what I think is an interesting question, which is, do we really need a smart refrigerator, right? In other words, everything now is inculcated, right? I mean, quote unquote, not literally everything, but figuratively, everything is inculcated with this smart capability. And the pushback on that is very much bread and butter economics. Do I want to spend another $100 on X? Do I want, and then this article is terrific, right? You know, are we going to have schools that can buy a $150 laptop, right? As public schools that are already strapped for money, right, have been doing. And so to me, one of the big pushbacks, I think, on AI is very much paraphrasing James Carville. It's the economy. And if AI actually drives up costs, right, for the average person rather than down, to me, put aside the law, and it's sacrilege for a law professor to say it, but put aside the law, the market drives the analysis. What's your take on that, and where do you see that kind of market analysis coming up in the research and the evidence that you gathered?
Well, it's again, sort of a whole body experience, so that there are ways in which AI potentially drives down the cost of things because it makes some kind of workers more productive. But the thing that's now driving so much of the concern is that we've gotten the first wave of data from hiring from certainly in the summer and fall of 2025 of new college graduates or people who are entering the job market and things like that. And there's some signs of distress that potentially are directly tied to hiring because companies are not rehiring or not rehiring for people who have been promoted or left or something like that. They're using AI tools to do that instead. And there's a bigger perception that AI is just a longer term menace to the future of jobs and things like that. And of course, that ties to the thing that we've been talking about, because so many people, especially Americans, think that their dignity, their meaning in life, their essential purpose is very deeply tied to their jobs. So what does that look like when jobs are not necessarily the thing that is helped by AI? The other thing that you refer to is represented in people's direct lives more specifically because of electricity bills. Yep. We've gotten our first wave of polling about how communities feel about data centers. Generally, they're not enthusiastic about them, even relatively far away placement, and they're concerned about electric bills and things like that. So there are ways in which this is becoming more of a systems problem, not necessarily a hardware for computers problem. This is something that is showing up in a bunch of ways in people's lives. It is the big pain point. If people think that their economic well-being is at stake, that this is as you said, this is it's the economy, stupid, in particularly in voting contexts. Yeah.
Last question for you, Lee, because I know you have to go. We are both educators, right? We're both affiliated with Elon. Elon's taken, at a university level, right? And I think understandably and appropriately, right, a very strong interest in making sure that our students understand AI, and at least have capabilities around it. My personal concern continues to be de-skilling, right? And I know this is reflected in the report that the foundational skills, particularly that students need, that can easily be replicated, which is not at this point the kind of nuanced thinking, but the right summary of facts and things like that, people need to be able to do. So my big last question for you on this report, right, is as students, right, and I always like to end my shows by thinking about the next generation of people entering our world, right? Whether I teach at the law school, so whether it's law students, who, by the way, and this is shameless self-promotion, 91% bar pass rate for our 2025 class in North Carolina. Super great news for our school, and I'm so proud of our students. But also at the Elon undergrad level, how do the experts think, the experts in your report think, students, people learning the skills that AI is in theory replicating, right, should use AI?
Well, they're very consistent in their view that it's a disrupted environment in the kind of ways that we were talking about before. AI literacy now is a precondition for lots of elements of life, even if it means that you're not necessarily a fan of using, at least knowing what it's doing is a pretty strong recommendation from lots of these experts. And I'm going to take this moment to plug two other things that Elon does that are very relevant to your question. We put out two student guides to AI. In 2024 and 2025, we put together basically a primer, a little pamphlet that basically marches you through what to be thinking about as you're a freshman or even a, you know, a high school upperclassman thinking about where to go to college and what to think about doing, how to think about using AI or how to employing AI or at least figuring out AI as you enter university and then plan to graduate from it. It's full of advice that is very practical about the things to master, the things to be wary of, the things to negotiate with your professors as you get assignments and things like that. And we're in May, we're going to put out a third guide. It's not necessarily a student guide, but it gets this higher level conversation that you and I are having. It's going to be about sort of time-tested, long-standing human wisdom and how to think about applying it to AI. So we quote a lot of philosophers in it. We quote a lot of people from around the globe who have thought about essential elements of being human and being a masterful human, someone who has the experience of well-being and joy and pleasure at life and this feeling of delight that only humans can have about learning things and mastering things. And so I would encourage, we'll send it to you when it's finally out. But there's been a lot of thinking about this. And one of the exciting things that's always is happening on campus is professors are engaging their students and in some cases asking their students to teach them. You know, some professors are basically saying, you'll get extra credit if you come to me and teach me something about AI that I didn't know. And so it's a co-learning environment, and it allows for people. There are people at Elon as well as many other campuses around the country who are not happy about this development, and nobody wants to have a top-down sort of everybody has to do it kind of regime in place. And so figuring out how to negotiate this on Elon's campus and in other campuses is one of the big jobs of academic leaders now.
And I do think that these insights ultimately, right, aggregating them, and you could use LLMs, you could use, you know, that to do that as well. And I know you in fact, you did use generative AI a bit in the report itself, as you mentioned, could be a good way to get there. Lee Rainey, thank you for joining us today, right? And of course, thanks also to your co-convener and my colleague, Jana Anderson, for putting out this report, Building a Human Resilience Infrastructure for the AI Age from Elon's Imagining the Digital Future Center. You can get the report now at imaginingthedigitalfuture.org. Lee, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Honestly, long time coming. It should have happened sooner, as many jazz musicians have said with their partnerships. I'm going to say it here as well. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsight Culture and on KZSU.
Fabulous to be with you, Dave. Thank you.
My pleasure. KZSU and Stanford, right, continue to push forward with our programming. Hearsayculture.com, again, celebrating its 20-year anniversary next month, May 2026. Check out hearsayculture.com for more information about that. Stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.